Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Ralph Compton's Trail of the Gunfighter series. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Danny Gavigan, David Coyne, Tracy Oliveira, Jeff Allen, Michael Glenn, Elizabeth Jernigan, Nanette Savard, Dylan Lynch, Eric Messner, Drew Copas, Michael John Casey, Nick DePinto, Tim Carlin, Gary Tells, Christopher Graybill, Scott McCormick, Joe Brack, Bradley Smith, James Lewis, Barbara Pinellini, Patrick Bussink, Lily Beacon, Ted Stoddard, Ken Jackson, Joel David Santner, James Keegan, Ren Casey, Richard Rowan, Thomas Keegan, Christopher Sheeran, Johan Detweiler, Tony Nam, Yasmin Toison, Margie Tompros, Kimberly Gilbert, Alyssa Wilmoth, and Mort Shelby. Trail of the Gunfighter Number 2, The Killing Season, Part 2. After thwarting the band that had been robbing the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, Nathan had returned to Dodge City. Waiting for him at the Dodge House was a heavily veiled woman. When she revealed her identity, Nathan was surprised to see Melanie Gavin.
Come up to my room, unless you fear for your reputation.
There's nothing either of us could do that would worsen my reputation. If I wasn't such a coward, I'd kill myself. But I need to speak to you.
Let's go.
Arriving at his room, Nathan let them in. It was easy to see Melanie was nervous, and he tried to put her at ease instead of letting her pace the floor.
Let me get you a chair.
No, thank you. You sit, please.
All right. Yeah. Now, you talk and I'll listen.
First, I have something to show you.
She removed the hat and veil, revealing a massive bruise that spread from her mouth and chin to her right cheek.
My God.
That's just the beginning. There's more.
With less modesty than Nathan expected, she unbuttoned her dress and let it fall to the floor. She wore nothing beneath it. There were black and blue bruises from her knees to her shoulders.
I should have killed that bastard Shanklin when I had the chance. I suppose he thought he had a reason for that?
Yes. He believed it was something I told you that caused you to change the schedule on that shipment from the mines. He threatened to kill me.
Why didn't you go to the law?
Then he would have killed me. I had no proof he'd done anything, although I knew he was planning to.
Have you been to a doctor?
No. I was ashamed to go. I only wanted to get away from him.
So you came to me. What am I supposed to do with you?
Nothing. I was hoping I might stay with you until...
But you have no proof, nothing that can be used against Shanklin.
No, but I can tell you what he said he's going to do, and the names of the men he's been talking to.
Yeah, I want to hear all that. While we don't have any real evidence, I want to know what he's planning to do. Now, why don't you get dressed and we'll go to Delmonico's for some food.
I'm ashamed to be seen with my face looking like this. Maybe later, tomorrow.
The more Nathan looked at her, the more she reminded him of Molly Tremaine. She sat on the bed beside him, and the next thing he knew, she had her arms around him, weeping as though her heart would break. Finally, the tears subsided, and when her eyes looked into his, Nathan felt chills creeping up his spine.
Please, I'm not hungry. Perhaps after dark, when nobody can see me so well. All I want is someone who cares, someone who won't hurt me. I'm so tired. I haven't slept in days. Could I stay here for just a while?
The way she tilted her head, the way her dark eyes met his, she reminded Nathan all the more of Molly Tremaine. Nathan grew weak in the knees, and his heart felt like it had risen to his throat.
Yeah, you stay here and sleep. I have some railroad business to attend to. When I get back, we'll go to supper.
Nathan walked down the hall, breathing hard. She brought back so many memories of Molly.
With his mind in a turmoil, he left the Dodge House. As he walked into the street, he saw a muzzle flash. A slug furrowed the flesh along his left side. A second one narrowly missed his head. Drawing his Colt, he started across the street on the run, but there were no more shots. He could still smell powder smoke when he reached the alley, but there was no sign of the gunman. There were saloons and innumerable other places of business whose back doors opened into the alley, and a search would be fruitless. As Nathan turned back toward the Dodge House, several men gathered, drawn by the shooting. One of them was Sheriff Harrington, who noticed the blood on Nathan's shirt.
Ambush, I reckon.
Good try. I lost him in the alley.
Yeah, well, see the doc, then come back by my office.
After the doctor swabbed and bandaged Nathan's wound, he went to Harrington's office. From his desk drawer, the sheriff took a sheet of paper. This he passed to Nathan. It was a telegram addressed to Sheriff Dodge City.
Melanie Gavin missing. Stop. My daughter. Stop. Respond if whereabouts known. Stop. Elsa Gavin, Pueblo, Colorado.
Should I answer this?
No. I can't tell you anything at this point, except that the girl fears for her life, and I believe she has a reason to. She's been involved with a man who has a contract with the mines for the hauling of silver to the railroad. I have reason to believe this varmint is a thief himself, or is selling information to outlaws. I'm telling you this in confidence, only because the girl, Melanie Gavin, is here asking for help.
Well, I'll sit on it then. But there's something about this that doesn't ring true. If Elsa Gavin is so concerned about her daughter, if they're that close, why did the girl turn to you instead of her mother? Is there no law in that town?
The law there is just like the law anywhere else. They don't care a damn about your suspicions. They want proof. And I know there's been considerable conflict between mother and daughter over a no-account varmint named Clell Shanklin.
Shanklin being the questionable hombre who has the hauling contract with the mines, I reckon.
Yes, I told you enough. You know as much as I do. Until I'm sure where Elsa Gavin stands, I'm telling her nothing. Shanklin could be behind this telegram you received.
My God! You believe the girl's mother betray her to a man who's trying to kill her?
I don't know, but I'm not going to risk it. This Shanklin is slick as a greased pig, and I want to put it past him, playing both ends against the middle. Suppose he's been using both the mother and the daughter. He might then turn one against the other if it suited his purpose.
I see what you mean. You think that ambush a while ago had anything to do with the situation in Pueblo?
I don't see how. Since I left, there's been only one train from there, and that's today's, the one on which Melanie arrived. Now, I reckon I've managed to accumulate enough people who want to see me dead, that they're everywhere.
After his meeting with Harrington, Nathan returned to the railroad terminal and Foster Hagerman's office.
You know about the telegram that came from Pueblo this morning, I reckon. Supposedly from Elsa Gavin to Sheriff Harrington.
Supposedly?
You heard me right. The girl's afraid for her life, and I can't imagine Elsa Gavin not being aware of that. Can you?
This whole thing may be deeper than we thought then. My God, how can a woman betray her own daughter to a man who's trying to kill her?
We don't know that's the case, but it's starting to look that way. I'll be talking to Melanie tonight, after she's rested. Maybe we can nail down some truth from all our suspicions.
There's blood on your shirt. Did that have anything to do with the gunfire I heard a while ago?
It did, a bushwhacker, and he got away.
You're about to uncover something in Colorado. Perhaps I should hire some men to help you.
No, that would only get him more targets. I work better alone.
We have a few days before there's another military payroll, and there won't be another mine shipment until next month. When you're ready to spend a few days in Pueblo, let me know.
It's going to take some time, getting information out of Melanie Gavin, and when I go, I want to leave her here.
If you need a room for her, the railroad will pay for it.
We can manage. I promised her protection, and I can't guarantee that with her in a room alone, can I?
Hardly.
When Nathan returned to his room, Melanie sat up, rubbing her eyes, and the bruise on her face didn't look quite as severe. He locked the door and sat down on the bed beside her.
Yeah, the sheriff received a telegram this morning. Your mother's name was signed to it. She wants to know where you are.
Oh, God, you didn't let him tell her.
He hasn't answered the telegram. I asked him not to, at least until I had talked to you. Why don't you want your mother knowing where you are?
Because she'll tell him. Why do you think I left without telling her?
Somehow, I got the impression your mother hated Clell Shanklin and was opposed to you being involved with him.
She did, for a while, but things have changed. She accused him of ruining me, but then she became less and less critical. And just within the past few days, I found out about them.
Shanklin threw you over for your mother?
No, he's been using us both. We've always operated the cafe in shifts. Both of us are never there at the same time. When I'd be there, he'd spend time with her. And when she'd be there, he'd spend time with me.
My God, I never heard of such. Do you think your mother is part of Shanklin's schemes?
I don't know. Just as I don't know if she would help him find me. I do know that she'll take his word over mine, because she's called me a liar when I've tried to tell her what he was doing to us.
I reckon it's best that they don't know where you are, then. I'm to go back to Pueblo for a few days and see what I can learn.
You're going to leave me?
I must, if I'm ever going to get to the bottom of this, but you won't be alone. I'll introduce you to Sheriff Harrington, and he'll keep an eye on you. Anyway, I won't be going until you're feeling better. Now, I want you to think of what you know about Clell Shanklin. Anything that might be helpful to me in building a case against him.
Back when he was still talking to me about his plans, he spoke of Chapa Gonzalez. He's a Spaniard and an outlaw from Santa Fe. It is he and his band of robbers who would stop the train and take the silver. In a wagon, they would take it into New Mexico, where it would be hidden until they could dispose of it. Clell wouldn't take part in the robbery, leaving him in a position to pass along information to the thieves about other shipments. I think he had already sent them word when the last shipment was going out. And when you took it a day early, it spoiled their plans. That's when he beat me and threatened to kill me, when he heard the locomotive whistle on Sunday morning.
Can you think of anything else?
Once, when I was at the freight office, men were unloading cases of dynamite from one of the wagons. When I asked him what the dynamite was for, he only laughed.
It'll be dark in a few minutes. You feeling well enough to go out for supper?
I suppose I'll have to. I haven't eaten since the night before I left Pueblo.
She threw back the covers and sat up, and again Nathan saw the ugly bruises that all but covered her body. He handed her the wrinkled dress from where she had left it, and it brought to mind a question.
Didn't you bring any clothes with you?
Only what I was wearing. I bought the hat and the veil at a secondhand shop after I left the hotel.
Hotel?
Where I stayed with him when he wanted me.
She kept her head down, her eyes not meeting his. Clenching his fists, he thought of her with Clell Shanklin, but his face was expressionless when she again looked at him. After putting on her shoes, she stood up and pulled the dress over her head.
Would you button it for me? My arms are so sore.
I'll try.
She started to smile as he fumbled with the buttons, and she finally had to laugh at his clumsiness, causing him to fumble all the more. She even laughed as he remembered Molly laughing.
There. Now you can go out in public.
Thank you.
But don't wear the hat and veil. It'll only make you seem more obvious.
Reaching Delmonico's, Nathan found Sheriff Harrington was there.
We're going to join Sheriff Harrington. He's a good man, and he's been a friend to me. I want you to meet him.
No, not now.
Now.
Harrington slid back his chair and stood as they approached his table.
Sheriff Harrington, this is Melanie Gavin. May we join you?
Please do. Pleased to meet you, Miss Gavin.
For a while, Melanie said nothing, her eyes on the table. Gradually, however, Nathan and the sheriff gained her interest, recalling humorous events involving themselves and others. By the time their supper was served, she had joined in, and when the meal ended, she seemed genuinely sorry to part with the friendly sheriff.
Well, it was a pleasure to meet you, Miss Gavin.
Melanie, please. Thank you for a lovely time, Sheriff.
Nathan, I'll be seeing you soon.
Well, you survived that. Now we're going to Mercantile and buy you some clothes.
I have no money.
You're in luck, because I do.
She was reluctant at first, but her eyes sparkled as she tried on various dresses, and Nathan found himself enjoying her all the more. She finally settled on 3 dresses, a pair of shoes, and a bonnet. They returned to the Dodge house, Nathan apprehensive. Were his feelings for this girl genuine? Or was he infatuated with her because in so many ways she reminded him of Molly Tremaine? She hung her new dresses in the closet, admiring them as she did so. She kicked off her shoes, unbuttoned the dress she wore, and stepped out of it. Uncertainly, Nathan watched her get into bed. Finally, he sat down beside her, and when she spoke, he was unprepared for her bitter words.
You don't want me, do you? Well, I don't blame you. I'm used goods.
Nathan flung the cover off her and drew her to him, kissing her long and hard.
Damn it, Melanie Gavin, I do want you. I've wanted you ever since that first time I saw you in a cafe in Pueblo. Will you marry me?
For a long moment, she said nothing. And even in the poor light from the lamp, he could see the tears on her cheeks.
No, I won't. It's too late to make an honest woman out of me. And I won't let you do something you'd regret later. Take me if you want me. It's the least I can do for a man who's been kind to me. Believe me, I have feelings for you, and I'm thankful for that. I never believed I could care for a man again after him.
It was a dilemma such as Nathan had never faced. Molly Tremaine had been the first woman in his life, and he had taken her without hesitation. Now Melanie, who reminded him so much of Molly, had refused his proposal of marriage. Feeling damned if he did and damned if he didn't, Nathan removed his clothes, blew out the lamp, and joined her in the bed. When Nathan awoke, the sun was streaming in through the window. Melanie sat with her knees drawn up under her chin, her eyes on him.
How do you feel?
Not nearly as guilty as I'd expected.
5 years ago, I might have said that.
I should put those 5 years behind you. I don't care about your past or what you were. All I can see is what you are now.
And what is that?
The most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life.
Beauty is only skin deep. Perhaps you haven't looked deep enough.
I made up my mind about you last night. Nothing you can say or do will change the way I feel.
I don't believe you. I don't believe there's a man alive who will buy the cow when he's getting the milk for free.
Then there's still something about men you don't know. When a man knows what he wants, he's willing to do what it takes to get it. He wants to own it honestly, and to possess it any other way goes against the grain.
Even if it's already been owned by scum like Clell Shanklin?
That's not important.
You're right, Nathan Stone. I don't know you. I've never known anyone like you. Give me some time. Then, if you still want me, then perhaps I'll believe.
I can wait. As long as I don't have to listen to you relive the last 5 years. Can you put that behind you and leave it there?
With your help, I can.
With that admission, all that had been missing the night before fell into place. Nathan no longer attempted to drive memories of Molly Tremaine from his mind. He didn't know where Molly ended and Melanie began, and he didn't care. Nathan spent a week with Melanie before again meeting with Foster Hagerman. Hagerman told Nathan of the death of the AT&SF president, Pierce Malone. Nathan made known his feelings for Melanie Gavin and arranged for Hagerman and Sheriff Harrington to see to the woman's welfare while he was away in Pueblo. Reaching Pueblo, Nathan went immediately to the Starlight Cafe, only to find it closed, an out-of-business sign posted on the front door. He checked into a hotel, hoping to attract less attention than he might by staying at the terminal bunkhouse. Nathan had no idea where Elsa Gavin lived, and he set about finding her. He began with the railroad dispatcher, who suggested he try the county courthouse. When Nathan found the courthouse, it was locked and vacant. Then he went to Shanklin's freight yard. After waiting until nobody was around, he climbed the steps to the dock, only to come face to face with a man leaving the office.
I'm looking for a gent named Shanklin.
He ain't here. What can I do for you?
Nothing. I'll try another time. When will he be returning?
He never bothers telling anybody, and I ain't sure if it's any of your business.
Unsure as to his next move, Nathan returned to the county courthouse and inquired about freight lines. He was given the names of three, including Clell Shanklin's. He called on Moore's Freight first, finding the owner, Carlisle Moore, was out of town. Calling on Colbert Lines, he found Taylor Colbert available but uncooperative. Finally, Nathan called on Sheriff Red Brody, introducing himself and revealing his position with the AT&SF.
I really need to talk to Clell Shanklin, since he has a hauling contract with the mines up near Denver.
I reckon he's in Denver. Whole town's been talking about him, but his freighting business had nothing to do with it. He's been sparking the Gavin gal since she was 19, and everybody reckoned they'd end up tying the knot. Well, a little more than a week ago, the gal just plumb disappeared. Day before yesterday, old Shanklin just up and marries Elsa, the gal's mother. She closed that cafe pronto, and her and Shanklin lit out for Denver. I reckon nobody will be seeing him for a while.
Thanks, Sheriff.
Nathan went to the railroad dispatcher's office and sent a telegram to Hagerman at Dodge City.
Send names of mines and persons responsible for silver shipments. Stop. Riding to Denver. Stop. Stone.
Within minutes, he had the names of four mines and their superintendents. He rented a horse and saddle at the livery stable and started the 150-mile ride to Denver. The silver mines, as he recalled, were all south of Denver. He needed to learn what might be expected in future shipments. He recalled that some shipments left from Denver on the Kansas Pacific, which was far more convenient. The hauling of shipments to Pueblo was intended to confuse train robbers, which was pointless if Shanklin was in cahoots with them. Nathan wondered if Shanklin also owned the contract to ship silver from Denver. He rode to each of the four mines, identified himself, and gathered the mine superintendents. There was Bannister of the Silver Slipper, Knowles of the Five Star, Ledbetter of the Half Moon, and Chapman of the Pharaoh.
Gents, I'm here on behalf of the AT&SF. We're concerned about getting your shipments to Kansas City. We avoided a robbery last time by a last-minute change of schedule, sending your shipments a day early. I'd like to know, for our sake and yours, how and when the next shipment will be going.
October 5th, by the Kansas Pacific.
Who has your hauling contract from the mines to the railroad?
Shanklin. Same as the shipments on the AT&SF.
Suppose I tell you that we suspect Shanklin of selling you out to thieves.
I'd want to see some proof. He turned in a low bid for the job.
I don't have any proof, but with your help, I believe I can get some.
It depends on what we got to do.
You'll go ahead with your shipment from Denver as planned, but with some changes. Shanklin will deliver that shipment. Those bags will be loaded with sand and sealed. The real shipment, about which Shanklin will know nothing, will go to Kansas City on the AT&SF. I'll bring a wagon and some line riders from Pueblo on October 1st, and your shipment will go out on schedule.
So, we send a bogus shipment and a genuine shipment, and you're telling us that the real one will go through while the bogus one is stolen.
That's what I'm telling you. Send your genuine shipment from Denver and you'll lose it. Can you afford the risk?
Hell no! I know you ain't rode all the way up here without good reason. If Shanklin's selling us out, we need to know. I say we go with Stone's plan.
Hayes, Kansas, August 25th, 1874.
Damn it, Elsa, I know what I'm doing. Gonzalo's and his boys was mad as hell when that last shipment slipped through a day early. Now I need to redeem myself, and this Kansas Pacific shipment should do it.
This time you can't blame it on Melanie. I can't believe she's gone.
I told you what she had to say when I broke up with her. She knows it's you and me, and she's gone off to sulk. She wants nothing more to do with you. Why do you reckon you've had no answer to your telegrams?
I suppose I'm getting what I deserve. 10 days ago, I had a business of my own, a life of my own, and a daughter. Now all I have are the clothes on my back, a room in a grubby Plains hotel, and a husband who's a damn thief.
Elsa, you took me for better or worse, and you knew what the worst was going in. I'm a thief, but by God, I tried all the other ways, and you know what I got? A few mules, some second-hand wagons, and the never-ending drudgery of hauling other men's silver and gold. I aim to end up rich or dead.
And I have an idea which it's going to be. How much longer do we have to squat here waiting for this mangy coyote of a Mexican outlaw?
Chopper will be here when he gets here. And if you're smart, you'll be a mite more cautious how you speak of him when he's around. Chopper don't appreciate disloyalty. And whatever you think of our plans, you'll do well to keep your mouth shut.
When Chapa Gonzalez arrived, he stared at Elsa for a long moment, his expressionless black eyes roaming over her. He was every bit the Spaniard, with flat-crowned black hat, polished black boots, and black frock coat. Instead of a belt, there was a crimson sash around his middle, and he had a rawhide thong around his neck. Down his back, Indian fashion, hung a formidable bowie knife. There was an ominous bulge beneath his coat, under each armpit. Following his initial rude stare, he turned his attention to Shanklin, ignoring Elsa.
Ah, Señor Shanklin, the mulo hombre whose trains run on silent tracks and whose silver is so fine the eye cannot see.
Damn it, Chopper, that wasn't my fault. The information was good when I gave it to you. The railroad changed schedule at the last minute.
You will see that it does not happen a second time.
The next shipment goes out October 5th on the Kansas Pacific, and you should stop the train 100 miles west of here, just after it leaves Colorado. You'll need two wagons. You'll be 425 miles east of Santa Fe.
17 days. Time enough for the law to follow.
The nearest town will be Hayes, where we are right now. Six men only, one to drive each wagon and four others as guards. The rest of the men will follow the wagons, prepared for the emboscada.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, he gives me the creeps. He reminds me of an undertaker.
Under certain circumstances, that's what he is.
And you're going to double-cross him?
In a manner of speaking, but not money-wise. We'll be riding to Santa Fe for our share of the money, and as far as Chapa knows, I'll return to Pueblo and continue hauling for the mines. That's to prevent him from double-crossing me. He expects me to be there, feeding him information on future mine shipments, but all I need is one good stake, and we'll be on our way to California.
I've heard that before. Melanie threw that in my face 5 years ago.
No, she lost faith. She could have been here where you are right now.
Lucky me.
Dodge City, Kansas, August 28, 1874. Upon returning to Dodge, Nathan went immediately to Hagerman's office and requested half a dozen guards for the October shipment out of Pueblo. Hagerman agreed to have the men ready. Nathan now was faced with the unpleasant duty of telling Melanie Gavin her mother had married Clell Shanklin. It was early afternoon, and he found Melanie reading copies of the various newspapers. She was pleased to see him, and he was pleased with her welcome.
What did you learn?
Nothing good. Looks like your mother and Shanklin threw in together. She closed the Starlight Cafe, and they both headed to Denver.
Oh, well, that's a shock. I don't know whether to laugh or to cry.
Maybe you should laugh. Before this is over, I reckon your mother will be crying enough for both of you.
I'm sorry for her, but there's nothing I can do.
She pulled the dress off of one shoulder.
My bruises are almost gone.
Even the one on your face. Have you been eating while I was away?
Oh, yes. I've been having breakfast with Sheriff Harrington, and Mr. Hagerman from the railroad took me to supper. They have been very, very kind.
Well, Hagerman's out of luck tonight because I'm taking you out to supper. I've missed the food at Delmonico's.
The last rays of the setting sun spread crimson fingers across the western sky as they left the Dodge House. The bushwhacker didn't get a chance for a second shot. Nathan ran toward the narrow passage between two buildings, and when he reached the rear of the structures, the wounded gunman was stumbling down the alley.
That's far enough. You're covered. Drop your gun.
But the bushwhacker turned. The gunman stumbled back against the wall of a store building and slid slowly to the ground.
Oh, Nathan, are you all right?
Yes.
He was reloading his Colt when Sheriff Harrington and a half a dozen other men came down the alley.
Again?
Again. But I don't know if it's the same man. I reckon I'll have to pay the Dodge House for a new door frame.
Might as well see who he is if we can.
Sheriff Harrington knelt beside the dead man. He removed a thin wallet from the corpse's hip pocket.
Who is he?
Kurt Limbaugh.
No,
God.
Do I have to shoot the whole family?
Well, damn if it don't look like it. Mom and Daddy may be next.
The sheriff and his men took charge of clearing up, and Nathan and Melanie continued to Delmonico's, where the shooting became the main topic of their conversation.
But how did he know where to find you?
As long as I'm with the railroad, I can't escape the newspapers. Every time I manage to outsmart some train robbers, it's news. It's the same every time I have to shoot some damn fool who's trying to kill me. I'm forever proving how fast I am with a gun, adding more names to a growing list of potential killers who want a reputation at my expense.
My God, when will it all end?
When I face a man who's faster than I am. And then he'll take up the burden I'm carrying now.
Why can't you just go away where nobody knows you? Must you work for the railroads?
It's a problem whether I'm working for the railroad or not. That's just a little easier to find me with the newspapers writing about me.
Dodge City, Kansas, September 4th, 1874.
Monday morning, there'll be another military payroll coming from Kansas City. I'll want you on that train. You knocked out two-thirds of that gang the last time they struck, but they've had time to recruit some more men.
I've been meaning to ask you why these varmints always know when there's a military payroll on board. Why can't you reschedule the shipment like we did from the mine, send it on a different train on short notice?
There are several reasons. The first, of course, is because of the way the military does things. They always pay between the 1st and the 10th of the month, come hell or high water. In the case of the payrolls we handle, they always come out of Fort Leavenworth, and they always arrive the day before they're to be shipped. Now, the other reason is that any band of outlaws with an eye towards stealing a payroll need only have a man watching the fort. When the payroll and its escort move out, it means one of the next day's westbounds will have the shipment aboard. The outlaws will stop every train until they get the one they want.
So there's no better way than just defending the train carrying the payroll?
That's it. This last bunch had a fondness for dynamiting the express coach. It worked, because nobody thought of attacking them like you did. Now, we don't know how they'll come at us, so you'll have to be prepared for anything. I can send some armed men with you if you wish.
No, but there is one thing you can do. Let 338 and her crew make that run.
Well, they're not scheduled for it, but if they're willing, I can make the change.
Kansas City, Missouri, September 6th, 1874. Nathan arrived on Sunday afternoon and went immediately to the terminal's huge call board. The crew he had requested, Dub Collins, engineer, Amos Handy, fireman, Art Raines, baggage man, and Enos Pillpaw, brakeman, had been assigned the early morning run, which would carry the military payroll to Dodge. Nathan bought copies of the St. Louis Globe Democrat and the Kansas City Liberty Tribune and headed back to the terminal bunkhouse. As he was perusing the papers, Enos Pillpaw and Art Raines arrived. Then Dub Collins and Amos Handy came in.
I hope I didn't spoil anybody's plans.
When you work for the railroad, you don't make a lot of plans. We was told you asked for us on this run, and we took that as a compliment.
Well, I asked for you gents because I know I can count on you not to fall into the jitters if the train robbers come after us. Last time, we pretty well cured them of dynamite in the express car, so I reckon we can look for something different if they come after us this time. Dub, I want you and Amos to arm yourselves with Winchesters. Enos, that goes for you too. Art, you're the exception because you'll be locked in.
No matter. I've cut some rifle holes on each side of the express car, so I can use a rifle too if they come within range.
Trouble is, if they come after us this time, we don't know what they might do. Dub, you and Amos keep close watch on the track ahead. They could dynamite the track and derail the train. If they rip a rail loose like they've been doing, then we can count on them attacking the train in some manner. Our defense will depend on how they attack us.
If they rip a rail loose and try and rush us, I can always reverse the train and leave them smelling our smoke.
You could, but don't do it at the risk of getting yourself shot.
By 5 o'clock the next morning, Nathan was again riding the caboose of 338. They took on wood and water at Wichita, and by the time they reached Newton, Nathan was beginning to wonder if the outlaws had given up. But half an hour west of Newton, the train began to slow. Nathan raised the cupola of the caboose and for a moment saw nothing. He then saw the outlaws approaching the train from two directions. They reined up and fired rifles into both sides of the engine. As Nathan climbed out on top of the caboose, he hoped the trainmen had taken cover. He fired his Winchester, but the 14 outlaws were still out of range. Suddenly, six of them galloped closer, and lead zipped all around Nathan like angry bees. He was forced back inside the caboose as slugs tore into the cupola. Enos opened the caboose's back door and was leaning around the car, firing at the outlaws creeping alongside the train. Outlaw fire struck his Winchester, tearing it from his hands and driving him back inside the caboose.
Four of them are covering the engine, and the others are working their way back to us, using the train for cover. Their fire cost me my rifle.
Take mine. I'm going to get out on top of this train and go after the varmints who are coming after us. Get just far enough up to see out this cupola and lay down enough fire so those mounted coyotes near the engine can't pick me off the roof.
Nathan reached the roof and leaned over the edge. Enos fired from the roof of the caboose, and while the outlaws beyond the engine posed no threat, those creeping alongside the train were in a far better position than the defenders. There was a tender, a boxcar, the express coach, and the caboose. In a matter of minutes, those using the train for cover would rush Enos. Suddenly, the train lurched backward and began to move. Dub Collins was alive and well. Rapidly, the train gained speed, exposing the 10 outlaws who had been using it for cover. Nathan stood atop the swaying train, a Colt in each hand. 10 of the outlaws were down. The 4 mounted men galloped after the train. After one was shot out of the saddle, the others reined up. Dub slowed the train as they neared the outskirts of Newton. Nathan continued along the tops of the cars until he reached the rear of the tender.
Good work, amigos. Anybody hurt?
We're still in one piece. We had to back off when things got too hot.
Glad you did. That was fast thinking, Dub. If you hadn't backed away from them, they'd have had us in a few more minutes.
There's a rail out. You want to telegraph Dodge and tell them we're rid of the outlaws and needing a work train?
Yes. I think we'll stay here at Newton for a while. Not all those varmints we gunned down are dead.
Newton had no depot as such, but there was a telegrapher's shack, and Nathan used the instrument to contact Hagerman at Dodge, requesting the work train come from Dodge rather than Kansas City or Wichita. He doubted there would be any more trouble from the train robbers, but he wanted the damaged track repaired before the train bearing the payroll continued on its way.
Figure 3 hours for the work train to get here, and an hour to repair the track, and that makes us 4 hours late.
Well, you can't have everything. We saved the payroll.
A big part of the credit goes to you gents in the cab, and Enos in the caboose, and I aim to see that the railroad knows it.
They waited 2.5 hours before they saw the dirty gray smoke against the blue of the western sky. Dub replied with a blast of 338's whistle. Nathan and Enos returned to the train's caboose as it lurched into motion. When they reached the site of the attempted robbery, none of the fallen outlaws were there.
I don't believe it. I know I shot 2 of them.
Well, you heard them. They didn't want us to know how bad. They toted away their dead along with the wounded.
By the time 338 was within sight of the twisted rail, the work train had arrived and men were hard at work. A little more than an hour later, 338 was steaming toward Dodge City on the tail of the returning work train. Dodge City, Kansas, September 7th, 1874.
Ah, another good piece of work.
I couldn't have done it without Dub Collins and his crew. The outlaws tore up the track and rushed us. Dub allowed most of them to dismount and begin working their way along using the train for cover. Then he backed up, exposing them to our fire. We killed or wounded 11 of the 14. They carried away the dead, so we don't know how badly we hurt them.
Another fight or two like that. And it'll be damned hard for them to keep adding men to replace those who have been killed or quit.
Nathan returned to the Dodge House and to Melanie. There was little to do until the next shipment, almost a month later. Nathan and the wagons arrived in Denver. Shanklin's wagon should have taken the bogus shipment the day before, but Nathan rode ahead to the Silver Slipper to be sure. When he reached the mine, he learned that the genuine shipment was ready to be loaded and shipped. Loading the wagons required less than half an hour. Nathan signed a receipt for the shipment, and the caravan headed south toward Pueblo. Hayes, Kansas, October 5th, 1874.
Tomorrow we'll ride south. By then, Gonzalo's and his bunch should have the shipment and be well on their way to New Mexico territory.
I don't see why we couldn't have gone on to Santa Fe and met them there. I don't relish the idea of riding 400 miles with a thieving Spaniard and his greasy gang of train robbers.
Well, that's just too damn bad. I don't relish the idea of having them take those wagons somewhere else and leaving me set out on my hunkers in Santa Fe. We'll catch up and trail them as far as it takes to get our cut.
I suppose it hasn't crossed your mind, but there's other ways for them to take it all for themselves. They could just kill us.
They could, but I'm worth more to them alive than dead.
When you're dealing with thieves and killers, that can change.
Far to the south, near the Cimarron River, Chapa Gonzalez and his riders were having their share of trouble. They had what they believed to be a fortune in silver, but their wagon broke an axle. Gonzalo took an axe, and he pointed the handle of it at four of his dozen comrades. Take the axe and find a tree of the proper size.
But there are no trees!
Then ride until there is one! It was already late afternoon when the four men returned to the wagon. Behind his horse, on a rope, one of the outlaws dragged a length of cedar. Gonzalo gave it a critical look. It would have to do. But there was another problem. There was no jack in the wagon. Gather large flat stones. We will have to lift the wagon and lay them underneath it while the axle is replaced. Several of the men struggled to create a new axle from the cedar log while the others gathered stones. Finally, Gonzalez judged they had enough stones. Come, let us raise the wagon. Bring the log. But try as they might, using the would-be axle as a pry pole, they were unable to lift the heavy wagon. It must be unloaded. As they passed the heavy canvas bags from one man to another, they dropped one of the bags and a seam broke.
Madre de Dios! Sand!
Gonzalez grabbed the axe and slashed every bag within reach. We have no further need of the wagons. Señor Shanklin will soon be coming for what is due him. I think we will wait here by the river and see that he gets it. Pueblo, Colorado, October 8, 1874. Nathan's wagons reached the terminal without incident, and the shipment was loaded directly into the baggage car that would be coupled onto the next morning's eastbound. The dispatcher's office would remain open all night, and guards would be near the car at all times. Nathan returned to the terminal. He would remain there until it was time to board the eastbound the next morning. Western Kansas, on the Cimarron River, October 8, 1874. To the north of the Gonzalez camp, Clell Shanklin and Elsa had sighted the wagons on the bank of the Cimarron.
Ah, come on! What?
Shanklin swung down from his saddle and froze, for the ground was littered with mutilated canvas bags, all spilling out sand. Two of the outlaws seized Shanklin's arms.
Now hold on!
Gonzalez withdrew the deadly bowie knife and approached.
Wait!
Yeah!
One of the outlaws caught Elsa's horse, and she watched in horror as Gonzalez went to work on Shanklin.
Do not harm the woman. We will have use for her tonight.
Elsa put her hands over her ears, but she could still hear the terrified screams of Clell Shanklin. Dodge City, Kansas, October 26, 1874. In Foster Hageman's office to discuss the next silver shipment from Pueblo, Nathan was surprised when the railroad man handed him a letter of commendation from the mine owners. He, along with the AT&SF Railroad, had been praised for securing shipments from train robbers and assured of continued business.
Oh, that was sheer genius, sandbagging those outlaws with a shipment on the Kansas Pacific while taking the real shipment from Pueblo. The mines have learned a valuable lesson. They're buying their own wagons and hiring their own guards. The next shipment will leave Pueblo November 9th.
I hated doing that to the Kansas Pacific, but there was no other way to prove to the mining people that Shanklin was selling them out.
No harm was done. The Kansas Pacific has been told what we did and our reason for it. They were in no way liable for a stolen shipment. Ah, Harrington, have you come to congratulate Nathan?
No, but I have some news. I just returned from Fort Dodge. Lieutenant McCoy just returned from a patrol along the Cimarron. McCoy and his men saw Buzzard circling and decided to investigate. They found what was left of a man and a woman and two abandoned wagons. The wagons had been loaded with bags filled with sand. Some of the bags had been cut open, and all of them bore the names of Colorado silver mines. Since you're working with the railroad, I reckon this might mean something to you.
It does, and since it's no longer a secret, I'll tell you what happened. Okay, Hagerman?
Go ahead.
He told Harrington the strange story, starting with his becoming suspicious of Clell Shanklin and ending with the two shipments on separate railroads.
So you think Shanklin and Elsa, Melanie's mother, rode south to claim what they believed was a share of stolen silver?
Now, I don't just think it, I know it. The finish of it fits the little we know of what became of Shanklin and Elsa after they left Pueblo. They evidently traveled east, probably to Hayes, and from there rode south. They got everything that was coming to them, in spades.
Santa Fe, New Mexico, October 28, 1874. Here is the new plan. Sol and Kalpana, you will ride north and remain within sight of the mines. Then it matters not who hauls the silver. When the wagons leave, you will ride back and bring us the word. Somewhere north of the river, before they reach Pueblo, and the safety of the railroad, we will attack. We will seize the wagons, drive them west of the town, and then south to Santa Fe.
The wagons are slow and so near the town. There will be a sheriff and posse quickly. I like the train better. There are not so many hombres to kill us.
Estúpido! It takes but two men to drive the wagons. The rest of us fall behind and set up the emboscada.
Sí, but they do not always use the railroad from Pueblo. Last time, they do not.
They will not make fools of us. From this time on, the wagons come south. Go! November 7th, the day before the silver from the mines was to leave Pueblo on the eastbound, Nathan met with Foster Hagerman just before boarding the train west.
I understand the mines have hired a dozen armed men to escort the silver from the mines to Pueblo. The outlaws have always tried to rob the trains. Are you expecting them to try something different?
Wouldn't you? We've outsmarted them twice. And once the silver reaches the terminal, they have no way of knowing which train it'll be on. From the little Melanie's been able to tell me, these outlaws are led by Chapa Gonzalez, and they hole up somewhere to the south, probably in New Mexico.
Yeah, whatever happens, the silver's not our responsibility until it gets to the dispatcher's office and is locked safely away.
It'll be our job to get it safely to Dodge.
Pueblo, Colorado, November 9th, 1874. When Nathan reported to the dispatcher's office in Pueblo, he received grim news.
There is no silver. Yesterday, just north of the Arkansas River, outlaws killed everybody except one of the guards and took the wagons. The man who got away rode in, shot up bad. He died last night.
Has a posse gone after the outlaws?
Sheriff Brody and a dozen men rode out late yesterday. They haven't come back.
I suppose you've contacted Hagerman and Dodge?
I have. He wants you to meet with the deputy and get details when the sheriff returns.
The sun had just dipped below the horizon, and scarlet spears streaked the western sky when the weary cavalcade wound its way in from the south. The sheriff and three men led horses bearing the bodies of the rest of the posse. Nine men were roped belly down to their saddles. The four who had escaped had not done so unscathed, for bloody bandages were wrapped about their arms and legs. They dismounted, leaning wearily on their saddles. Sheriff Brody stumbled toward the office, making it as far as the steps before his wounded leg gave out. He sat on the steps, wiping his face with a bloody bandana.
You men who were hurt, into my office. Somebody get the doctor.
Men from the crowd untied the rope down dead, lifting them off their weary horses. Nathan helped remove one of the dead men who'd been shot 5 times in the back. It had been a slaughter of the most brutal kind.
Sheriff, I aim to round up that bunch of back-shooting coyotes, and I need your advice. But you need the doctor as much as the men inside.
Let the doctor finish with the others first.
Well, then tell me what you can. That bunch has to be stopped.
They ambushed us. The worst damn kind of ambush. There's at least a dozen of the varmints, and they split up. One bunch dropped back, and when we rode into them that was ahead of us, the others fell in behind and they just shot hell out of us. I should have laid back and forced them to ride on, but it was near dark and we thought we could take them. My God, there was a dozen of us. We got away in the dark, them of us that survived, but we was afoot. We hid out all night. And it took us most of today to catch up our horses and gather up our dead.
I'll be going after them. I represent the railroad, but there's more at stake here than stealing. I won't see 9 good men die in vain.
Without another word, he left. Sheriff Brody sat, brooding and bleeding, on his office steps. Nathan went to the nearest livery and rented a horse and saddle. At a mercantile, he bought a bedroll, saddlebags, and provisions for a week. When he returned to the dispatcher's office, he sent a telegram to Foster Hagerman at Dodge.
Posse wiped out. Stop. Going after outlaws. Stop. Stone.
He didn't wait for an answer because he knew what the answer would be. The railroad bore no responsibility for the stolen silver, but sight of the dead men, brutally shot in the back over riches not their own, had ignited a spark in Nathan. He recalled Captain Sage Jennings, shot in the back by a cowardly bushwhacker. But most of all, he could see in his mind's eye the evil El Gato, who had, with his band of killers, destroyed a part of Nathan Stone's life in the wilds of Indian Territory. Although it seemed so long ago, it all came back. He slipped his Winchester into the boot and swung into the saddle.
Yeah.
Already it was dark, and while he couldn't take the trail until first light, he kicked the bay horse into a gallop, riding south. Reaching a creek, he dismounted. From his saddlebag, he took some strips of jerked beef for his supper.
The last thing those outlaws expect is to be pursued by just one man.
Dodge City, Kansas, November 10th, 1874.
Why did he go after them alone?
I don't really know. I sent him a telegram asking him to give it up, but he'd gone already. The silver was stolen before it was ever in our hands, so we couldn't be responsible for that.
Then there's nothing to do but wait and worry.
Chapa Gonzalez and his men had driven the teams unmercifully, and by sundown of the day following the ambush, they had crossed the Rio Grande into New Mexico.
It was as you say. We watch for the wagons, and they come south to us for the taking.
Gonzalez was pleased, for he had regained the confidence of his followers. No more robbing trains. They would take the silver as it came from the mines before it reached the railroad. Nathan rose at first light, saddled the bay, and rode south. He watched for barren ground, found the wagon tracks, and on top of them, tracks of many horses. He had no trouble identifying the scene of the ambush, for there was dried blood on dead leaves and grass, and bits of torn, bloody clothing. Once he had determined the direction they were traveling, Nathan rode a mile west and again rode south, paralleling their trail. When he reached the bank of the Rio Grande, he followed the river south until he found where the wagons had crossed. They had been traveling southwest, but after crossing the river, they followed the west bank. He recalled that Santa Fe was practically on the banks of the Rio Grande. As a precaution, he recrossed the river and, keeping well away from the east bank, began to follow it south. He would keep on their trail without stumbling into an ambush. The next day, Nathan saw a thin plume of dust ahead. He eased the bay down to a walk. The sun was 2 hours high, and he reined up and dismounted. He rested the horse for a while, and then led the animal down a low bank to water. Tonight, he would reach the outlaw camp. Chapa Gonzalez and his men had begun to feel safe, and with Santa Fe near, they were in a jovial mood, broiling huge slabs of antelope meat over an enormous fire. Since every man had a weapon handy, they hadn't posted sentries. Suddenly, Gonzalez dropped his hunk of meat in the fire and snatched his Winchester.
¿Qué pasa?
Silencio! But it seemed a false alarm, and they laughed as Gonzalez attempted to rescue his meat from the ashes. Taking his Winchester, Nathan left the bay at least a mile north of the outlaw camp. There was no wind to betray him, and the moon had yet to rise. The land was hilly, thick with cedar, and the starlight didn't penetrate the shadows. There were few dead leaves, and needles from pine and cedar made no noise under his boots. Once, as he neared the outlaw camp, Nathan stepped on a dead limb and it snapped. He froze as the outlaws became silent and watchful, moving ahead as they resumed their conversation and laughter. They were in a clearing, and he could see the firelight dancing off the canvas of the stolen wagons. Loss of this particular silver shipment didn't bother him nearly as much as the possibility of the outlaws escaping to steal and kill again. He wondered if there wasn't more of the lawman in him than he realized. But for that, what kind of damn fool would go after a dozen deadly outlaws who had virtually wiped out a sheriff's posse? As near the camp as he dared to go, Nathan paused. Now that he had caught up to the outlaws, what was he going to do? One man with a rifle could raise hell within a larger force. It was the simplest kind of warfare, where a sniper hurt the enemy as much as possible and then escaped to launch a new attack. In daylight, they might ride him down, but they would never find him in the dark. With that in mind, he raised his Winchester and, firing rapidly, shot three of the outlaws. He rolled away as they fired at his muzzle flashes, and like a cat, he was on his feet. He slipped among the cedars, keeping to the shadows, making his way back toward his horse. He loosed the reins, mounted, and rode several miles back up the river until he could no longer hear any sound of pursuit. As Nathan had hoped, the outlaws soon gave up any thought of pursuit, for a gunman could pick them off one at a time in the dark. Gonzalez put out the fire, lest the lone gunman circle around and attack from another direction.
Sangre de Cristo, he is El Diablo. He shoot 3 times in the dark, and 3 compañeros die.
El Diablo or not, he won't get away with this. He leaves tracks, we follow. Por Dios, come the dawn, we leave the wagons here. We find and kill this bastardo if we never do anything else. I, Chapa Gonzalez, have spoken.
Nathan was in the saddle at first light, prepared to stalk the outlaws. But to his dismay, they began stalking him. He could see puffs of dust at regular intervals as they advanced. There were several outcroppings of rock where he could have taken a stand, but with several of them keeping him pinned down, the others could circle around and get him from behind. He had to keep moving, lest they surround him, but his dust was as visible as was their own. Already their skirmish line had taken on the shape of a large horseshoe, with its open end moving to engulf him. The sun was growing hot, and already the bay was sweating. They would stalk him until his horse gave out and then ride him down. He had but one chance, and that was to break through their line to the south and outride them. He kicked the bay into a fast gallop. As long as they couldn't actually see him, he had a chance, but only if he broke through the line that was advancing to surround him. 2 of the approaching riders discovered what he had in mind and converged on him, shooting. Returning their fire, Nathan watched one man pitch from the saddle, but the other man fired, and Nathan felt the lead rip into his side. The rest of the riders had circled and were closing in. Another slug struck him in the back, high up. His bay was heaving and couldn't continue. Ahead, stretching across the Rio Grande, was a ridge of stone over which a cascade of water fell. There was an upthrust of stone on the east bank, head high. Nathan reined up the heaving bay and all but fell from the saddle.
He stumbled into the rocks just above the falls, realizing that he had left his Winchester in the saddle boot. But he had his Colts with enough shells to last him until he bled to death. The outlaws began to fire, and lead spat against the rocks. It would be a matter of minutes until some of the outlaws crossed the river and cut down on him from the west bank. In desperation, he began searching for a way out and discovered a narrow, treacherous path down the rocky slope alongside the waterfall. Holstering his Colts, he started down. The outlaws intensified their fire, and the slug burned a fiery path just above Nathan's left ear. Off balance, he fell into the roiling water at the foot of the falls.
Por Dios, ride in and be sure he is dead.
Several of the outlaws dismounted and made their way to the precipitous bank from which Nathan had fallen. There was no sign of a body in the water below, and after a while, even Gonzalez was convinced the man they had sought was dead.
Back to the wagons.
Before sundown, the wagons rumbled along the rutted Santa Fe Trail and reached the outskirts of the town of Santa Fe. There, the caravan turned eastward, and 5 miles into the barren land that was northeastern New Mexico, they reached a sprawling ranch that had come into existence more than 100 years previous by Spanish grant. In an arch above the gate hung a long wooden slab. In Spanish, burned into the wood in large letters, were the words Casa del Aguila. One man dismounted and opened the gate, allowing the 2 wagons to pass through. Chapa Gonzalez and his riders dismounted before the house he had inherited from his father. In Santa Fe, Chapa, as had been his father before him, was a respected citizen and the owner of a Spanish grant older than the town itself. Nathan had blacked out from the slug that had grazed his head. He came to his senses only when he was under the cold water. It was a narrow shelf of rock behind the falls, and after several failed tries, Nathan dragged himself up on it. So near to the falls was he that spray from it was flung in his face, but he was concealed from the men who had tried to kill him. There was little he could do but wait until they presumed him dead and rode away. He could feel the blood oozing out of his wounds, and if he did nothing else, he had to stop the bleeding. Besides being alive, there was one thing for which he could be thankful. There were exit wounds, telling him that neither slug had struck bone, for such a ricochet was almost always fatal. The spray in his face had a refreshing effect and kept him conscious most of the time. The constant spray had not allowed the blood to clot. He slid off the rock shelf and was in water neck deep. Fighting his way through the falls, he found it was late in the afternoon, the sun not more than an hour high. He waded to the shallows and stood there, listening. There, to his surprise, his saddled bay was grazing. The horse had been heaving with exhaustion, which accounted for the outlaws not having taken it. Nathan took handfuls of mud and, squeezing the water out of it, applied it to his wounds. His skull ached like 7 kinds of hell from the graze, and a faint stream of blood still trailed down his jaw. Despite having been soaked to the hide most of the day, his face felt hot. It was the beginning of a fever. Slowly, slipping and falling, he climbed the riverbank and headed for his grazing horse. The effort brought fresh blood flowing from his wounds. He knew not how far he was from Santa Fe. It would be his only source of aid, for he was 3 days south of Pueblo. 3 times he tried before he was able to drag himself into the saddle. He kicked the bay into a lope, following the river south. A faster gait might jolt him out of the saddle, and he was in no condition to stop and rest the horse. But he could only last so long, and finally he fell from the saddle and lay with unseeing eyes turned to the purple sky with its silent, twinkling stars.